It started to burn. I pushed the sleeve up to keep from getting blood on it, and my thumb sank into a bloody, ragged hole in my biceps. I stared in shock at the jagged tear momentarily and saw the main artery in the arm pulsating. It had been exposed but not torn. It seemed that half of the muscle was gone, and when I turned my attention back to the tree, I saw a mass of bloody flesh hanging from one of the spikes about 10 feet up the tree. I let out a yelp of horror and sped for home, followed by the other boys. I dashed into the house and showed the gaping wound to my mother in the upstairs bathroom, where she was finishing the chores that I was supposed to be doing. She turned white, then looked out the window and saw that Doc Weaver's car was parked in his garage in the alley below and behind our row of houses, and quickly sent me off to him. Doc Weaver was the town miracle worker who tended to any ailment known to befall humans. He dried my tears, calmed me down, stitched my wound closed, bandaged me up, and sent me on my way, all done with a quiet, methodical, soothing proficiency. I like to think that my parents paid him at some point for his services. Probably not, though. I wasn't expecting any medals when I got home, but neither was I expecting to be subjected to one of my father's fearsome outbursts. He had been summoned by one of my brothers from his place of work nearby. "See what you've done to your mother," he bellowed as he cuddled his sobbing wife in his arms. "Yeah, my poor mum. How could I have been so inconsiderate?" I spent the next few days confined to my bed. In our house, one didn't get sent to one's room, one got sent to bed, mainly because one didn't have a room of his own, nor an unshared bed, for that matter. It wasn't until decades later that I would learn that Paul had been at my side, and while he did not prevent the fall or the nasty cut, he did manage to pull my head back just enough to keep one of the spikes in the tree from catching me under the chin and possibly ripping out my jugular vein. At least that's what he implies, and I have no reason to disbelieve him. I know that I wasn't the fastest runner among the group of boys who witnessed my fall, but when we all stampeded toward my house, my feet suddenly acquired the wings of Mercury and I left even the fleetest among the group eating my dust. I turned my attention back to Mel, who had cracked open another beer, probably his third or fourth by now. "Hey, I have an idea," Mel said. "Let's go to a tavern and have a little party." He was feeling no pain at that point. My wife declined. And that gave Mel's wife an excuse to also beg off. The mere mention of going to the tavern seemed to cause a spasm of pain to rake across her face. I hadn't known Kathy as a kid. She was several grades behind Mel and was from his hometown. She looked like she probably was pretty, or at least cute, when she was younger, but time had blunted the features, grayed the hair, wrinkled the skin, and most likely had added a bit of weight to her fairly ample frame. She wasn't as tall as Mel, but I would have bet that she outweighed him by 20 or 30 pounds. I tried not to speculate on what the dullness in her eyes or the look of pain on her face at the mention of the tavern said about their private life. It was obvious through that she was relieved when my wife said she wasn't interested in going along. Kathy fairly bubbled with enthusiasm and offered to make some hot tea, suggesting that they would have a nice chat while we guys were out boozing. It was only after some resistance from Mel that I was able to talk him into letting me drive. The towns in Pennsylvania have an interesting feature that may or may not be unique to the state. That is, neighborhood beer bars are scattered throughout residential sections. Some of the homes actually have been converted to drinking establishments, with the bar in the parlor area and the rest of the house used as a residence. Mel guided me as I drove and we arrived at one of his favorite watering holes. There were two other people in the bar when we entered, besides the bartender. At the end of the bar sat a toothless old guy who looked to be 75, gazing into his glass of beer with his chin resting on his forearms that were folded onto the bar. A cigarette smoldered forgotten in the full ashtray in front of him and another dangled out of the corner of his mouth. The other was a large, beefy man also puffing on a cigarette with a full ashtray of stubs in front of him beside his glass of beer. Even though he looked to be mid to late 60s, he also looked tough and menacing as he gave us a long gaze up and down when we entered. He was wearing a sweat-stained blue work shirt with matching pants, and heavy work boots with white socks. Incongruously, he was holding a little mutt in his lap that was badly in need of some grooming of its matted coat. "Jimmy, my man, where's it at?" Mel hollered at the bartender as we took seats. "Hey, Mel, where you been hiding? Still doing that painting job? Where's Kathy? She let you out by yourself? Okay, I've got another designated driver tonight. Couple of brace keys," Jimmy asked. "Just a diet cola for me if you have one. Name's Phil," I added, reaching out a hand, which the bartender shook firmly. "Finished the painting job yesterday," Mel said to Jimmy. "Know of any other work around? I'm free for the moment. Might have some excavation work for a septic tank coming up though." Jimmy set the drinks down in front of us. Mel swilled half his glass of suds in one gulp. "I guess it would have been too much to expect a straw in this place, but even a glass to go with my Coke would have been a nice touch." I popped the top on the soda can and took a small swig. I was sitting to Mel's right and the other two patrons were seated to his left. As I faced Mel for conversation, I noticed that the burly character a couple of seats away in the middle of the bar still had his eyes fixed on us while he absent-mindedly petted the dog, which occasionally licked at some spilled beer on the bar and took a few laps from his owner's glass when it was offered. Mel noticed me looking past him and turned to see what was grabbing my attention. "Oh, hi, Eddie. How's it going? Kinda dark in here. I didn't recognize you at first," Mel said. He introduced me by name to the stranger. The big man gave me the eye. He gulped down the remainder of his beer and raised the glass to the bartender, who brought him another one. He stubbed out his cigarette and immediately lit another. Jimmy took the full ashtray, dumped its contents into the receptacle under the bar, wiped it with the towel over his shoulder and replaced it. I noticed that the dog licked the big man's mouth every once in a while, and instead of flinching away in disgust, the owner almost seemed to return the kiss. Maybe he had a tender side after all, even if it struck me as slightly repulsive. I couldn't come up with a last name for the big guy. But there was something familiar about him even after all this time. "This is Eddie Dwyer," Mel said. "You remember Eddie, don't you?" he asked me. "We used to horse around together when we were kids." Mel's mood had changed. He had gotten fidgety and I got the impression that he was being diffident, almost slavish toward the big man, whose presence obviously was making him uncomfortable. This was mostly below the surface, with just a subtle ripple of disturbance. Normally, I would have reached across Mel to offer the big man a hand, but there was something about him that told me to keep my distance. I simply nodded, said hi, and kept tracking my brain for some inkling of recognition, some piece of faded memory. There was indeed something vaguely familiar about the aged features, the name, but it proved too slippery for me to get my brain around. "We knew each other as kids?" Eddie asked. "I don't remember you. You live around here?" "California," I said. "Just visiting." Eddie snorted and took another long draw on his beer. I noticed that it took him only two gulps to finish a full glass. "Oh, the left coast. The land of fruits and nuts. You a fruit like your pal there?" Eddie asked. Mel laughed nervously. "Come on, Eddie, you know I'm not a fruit. Neither is he." Now Mel may be kind of wimpy, but he does have a sense of humor, which can emerge under even the most solemn occasion. He turned to look at me. "You aren't, are you?" he asked wickedly. If I had been taking a sip of my cola at the time, it surely would have squirted out of my nose as I burst into a spasm of laughter. Maybe being kicked around so much encouraged him to develop a defense mechanism of levity to try to defuse potentially explosive situations. Anyone could see that the scowling big man didn't get the joke. "Boy, that hit the spot. Well, we'd better get going," Mel said, throwing $2 or $3 bills on the bar. He took a step or two toward the door and I started to swing off my seat to join him. "What's your hurry?" Eddie demanded in a loud voice. "You two fairies going off to be alone?" Now I was getting nervous. The guy was not only base and ignorant, he was drunk to boot, and no man talks to people that way, stranger or acquaintance, unless he's looking for trouble. He was, and I sure wasn't. And it was obvious that Mel wasn't. The bartender busied himself with polishing beer glasses and avoiding eye contact with any of us. No, we just stopped in for a minute, Mel said hesitantly. Our wives are waiting for us. We're going out to dinner. The mangy mutt continued to periodically lick Eddie's slobbering lips even as he commanded Mel and me to sit down and have another beer with him. Well, okay, maybe just one more, but then we have to hit the road, Mel said, trying to control his voice and appear cheerful, but any halfway sober person could easily detect the nervousness in his manner and the stress in his voice, which almost cracked. Nothing else for me, thanks, I said, but I'll sit for a while until Mel's ready. Give them both a beer, Eddie said to the bartender, who immediately drew two glasses of draft and set them in front of us. Mel picked up his, nudged me nervously with his elbow, turned to Eddie and raised the glass in his direction, saying, thanks, Eddie. Here's to you. Mighty generous of you. I followed his example and raised my glass of beer toward the big man. Mel took a big gulp of his while I took a sip and placed the glass back on the bar. Eddie was preoccupied at the moment petting the mutt, baby talking to it, and returning its kisses. Mel took the opportunity during the distraction to speak to me sotto voce. We gotta get out here. I'll tell you about him later. He's trouble. Hell, don't thank me. I'm not buying your beers, Eddie said. I just said to stay and have another with me. Fact is, I'll even let you buy mine too on this round. Oh, sure, Mel said. He pulled out a bill and handed it to the bartender. It was embarrassing to see another person being so servile. I was now starting to get a little angry, although I kept it in check because even though Eddie was about my age, he was still a bruiser of a man, much larger than I. The door to the bar opened just then and a man stuck his head inside and asked if anyone there was driving a car with Rhode Island license plates. I was just about to answer when I saw the man's face. I found it more amusing than surprising. I replied that the car belonged to me. Paul asked if I could move it forward a little bit to allow him to maneuver his car out from behind. He said he was blocked in. I knew that was malarkey, of course. Paul didn't need to drive, and there was no car close to mine when I had parked earlier. I told Mel and Eddie that I'd be right back and stepped out into the humid darkness with Paul. My advice to you, young man, relatively speaking, I presume, is to vacate those premises unless you want a repeat of a lesson administered to you when you were a kid, Paul said. He didn't offer the advice with any sense of urgency, nor did he appear frantic or concerned in any way. I had no idea what he was talking about, nor could I remember any particular lesson that he had in mind, especially one that old. We stepped away from the front of the tavern to blend into the shadows. There was no car parked behind my rental. The darkness seemed to swallow up Paul and I lost sight of him momentarily. However, he had only dematerialized and now hovered by my rental car as an apparition. Anyone coming from the bar would have seen no sign of him or his car that supposedly had been blocked in. The presumption would be that I had moved my car, and that he had left. I don't understand, I said. What lesson? And if I learned it once, what's the problem with learning it again? You don't remember him, do you? Who? The big guy? Yes. It's one of the hooligans who used to knock you and Mel, as well as a few others around when you were kids. It started sounding familiar, but I still couldn't put my finger on a name. You hardly knew him by his real name, Paul said. You guys used to call him Simple Simon, but not to his face. Oh, my gosh, that's Simple Simon, I blurted. I remember that jerk. And you're right, he was always picking on the smaller guys. I had had numerous run-ins with him and at least one major altercation. When I was about 15 or 16, I had made a disparaging remark about him that was overheard by some little trollop who got her kicks out of stirring up trouble, and she passed on the word. Simple Simon eventually caught up with me out in the open. Normally, I would have tried to run away, but for some reason my resentment got the better of me and I stood up to him. I suppose it could have had something to do with the hormonal changes going on in my body at the time. I easily talked him out of battering me into a pulp then and there and got him to agree to meet me that evening at a location where teenagers hung out. We would then settle the matter man to man. Mel and some of his friends that I hung out with thought I was crazy. But defiance was raging through my body and I was tired of caving into the Neanderthals. I could have gotten my father or several of my brothers to step in on my behalf, but my pride precluded that. I had to fight my own battles. Unfortunately, moral indignation doesn't pack much of a punch, and so I got the stuffing beaten out of me. There's an old adage that a good big man will beat a good little man every time. Simple Simon was big and I was small, and that was just a fact of life that I had to live with. A couple of dozen local kids witnessed the carnage as Simple Simon pounded me at will. Every once in a while, I got in a lucky shot that stung his face or an ear, and I did manage to bloody his lip a bit. But for every wild swing that I landed, he hammered me with three or four solid punches. Most of them landed on my torso rather than on my face, which kept me from getting cut up too badly. But even the ones that slammed into a shoulder or my ribcage felt like a kick from a mule. I was really hurting. Finally, after climbing back to my feet half a dozen times, only to be pummeled back down, I just lay on the ground gasping. My whole body hurt, one eye was already closing, blood was oozing from my nose and a gash on my lower lip. Simple Simon sauntered away victorious, followed by several of his cronies and the most of the onlookers, while I licked my wounds. I was tended by Mel and several of his buddies, and a couple of neutral observers. But I also noticed that not one of the half dozen or so girls who had witnessed my humiliating defeat stuck around to commiserate with me. They all went skipping off with the victory party. The guys who stayed praised me for my bravery. But I wasn't sure what I had proved by my foolish act, probably nothing, because even though the bullying continued, I never fought back after that. The memory passed before my eyes in a flash while I was talking with Paul. "Let's get going," Paul said. "Get your buddy and go somewhere else, preferably home. He's drunk, you know." I knew Mel was drunk. Humans have historically sought ways to achieve an altered state of consciousness through mind-altering compounds. Mel was Joe Sixpack. I had stood up to Eddie only that one time and now, given this second opportunity, I wasn't in the mood to tuck my tail between my legs and skulk off into the shadows. Admittedly, I took a battering for my principles, but I had defended them as best I could. I informed Paul of my intentions to stick around. That was my right as a free citizen. "Besides," I said with a mischievous grin, "I don't have to worry now that I know you are at my side. I didn't know that when I was a kid. Besides that, just where were you back then when I was getting the tar wailed out of me?" He scornfully ignored the question. "Okay, I'm telling you frankly now that I'm not going to bail you out if you get into trouble in there. I've told you what you have to do. If you won't listen, I can't force you." I turned abruptly and walked away, entering the tavern even as Paul was still rebuking me. I took a seat between Mel and Simple Simon, which left only one empty stool between me and the big man. I noticed that Mel had finished his beer and was now working on mine. He finished it off and ordered two more. I was just about to object that I didn't want one when I realized that he was buying it for Simple Simon, not for me. I gave the ape a real visual go in hover now that I realized who he was. I suppose it was because I was now seeing him from my perspective as a man, rather than as a skinny kid. I was looking at him now with a lifetime of experience behind me. I still had the good sense to be nervous, but I wasn't cowering. Besides, if Paul really didn't care what kind of trouble I got myself into, why was he standing inside the door watching? Even more, why did he feel he had to let me know he was there? He was in his apparition mode. I took comfort from his presence. Simple Simon accepted his beer without a word of acknowledgement toward Mel. He was still preoccupied with that scruffy mutt and was still returning its occasional licks on the mouth. "Say, Eddie," I said, turning my back on Mel to stare into the gorilla's eyes, "I notice that your repulsive mutt periodically licks its ass and then occasionally licks you on the mouth, which you don't seem to mind. Why don't you just lick the dog's ass directly and save yourself a step in the process? The words had spilled out of me before I even had given them any thought and were now hanging frozen in the air. The bartender and Mel reacted with looks of astonishment, and even the old geezer down at the end of the bar, who had been in another world inside his head during this whole time, took his chin off his arms and looked up with glazed interest. Jimmy dropped a glass that he had been polishing, and Mel gave me a sharp poke in the ribs. The ape's face went even colder and harder, if that was possible. My guts were churning, but I remained resolute. Simple Simon finally found his tongue and the words came out in a raging slur. "What did you say?" he demanded as he slid off the bar stool. Mel jumped from his own stool and quickly placed himself between Eddie and me. That struck me as surprisingly courageous. He was just locking, Eddie. It was a joke. He's a big kidder. "Listen, we gotta get going," he said to me. "We are really late, gonna get into trouble with the ladies." "Let's go," he said, grabbing me by the arm. I stood my ground. "Now I remember you," Eddie said. Wise ass with a smart mouth. I doubted that he remembered me. It was a one-size-fits-all description that could have been applied to any number of people that he had clashed with. "Yeah, that's me. I never seem to learn. Yeah, I remember. Wise guy. Big mouth. You must be suicidal or something, eh? Or maybe you're packing a gun. You got a gun?" He shoved Mel aside like a bag of feathers. I was now about the same size that Eddie had been the last time he pounded me. If he had quit growing at that point and waited a few years until for me to catch up to him, we would have been pretty evenly matched. Unfortunately for me, he had grown also, and he was a fairly big man, slightly over 6 feet and easily 230 to 250 pounds. "No, I don't have a gun," I said. I didn't tell him that I wished I had, that it would have come in handy at the moment. He came at me slothfully and unevenly. I had no trouble backing away from him. "I'm not going to get into a bar and brawl," I told Eddie. "You want to fight me, let's do it right. Like old times. Outside. Private. Man to man. In the morning. You're drunk now." The brute paused. He seemed to mellow out somewhat. I could see the wheels turning in his head. I don't remember his ever losing a fight. Probably because he never picked on anyone of equal size, so he may have been recalling any one of hundreds of pleasing skirmishes of his youth. I negotiated with him, talked him into a later rematch of our previous fight. Something about the challenge seemed to appeal to him. If he was even capable of feeling, I believe that he felt there was a certain nostalgic romanticism about it. He could relive his youth, when life was a delight and full of promise, when he was young, strong, virile, fearless, and hadn't yet been beaten down by it. Perhaps that idea filled one of the empty spaces in what I suspected was probably a pretty drab existence. We agreed to meet the next day at 8 a.m. in a secluded spot not too far out of town, the site of our last bloody encounter, the blood having been mostly mine. I wasn't familiar with the area anymore, but Eddie was. It would be a Sunday and things would be relatively quiet. In exchange, Eddie would agree to not mop up the floor of the bar with me right at the moment. I started thinking that I should have listened to Paul. I was going to get my butt kicked again. I really hoped Paul was bluffing when he said he wouldn't intrude. If he wasn't, I needed a plan, and one was coming to mind. The sun rose on a fairly cool, partially cloudy morning, and by the time 8 a.m. rolled around there were about a dozen of us in the park-like area: Eddie, myself, Mel, Jimmy the bartender, the old coot at the end of the bar, who also brought his wife along, and maybe half a dozen others who had heard about the fight the way news travels in a small town. A small circle formed as Eddie stripped off his windbreaker and tossed it on the ground, where I also placed my jacket, neatly folded. I also had with me a black plastic case, which I placed on the ground. I snapped the case open, and the onlookers pressed in to see two ceremonial tomahawks displayed in the wells of a foam rubber insert. The hatchets bore carved Indian symbols and were decorated with colorful strips of what might have been dyed leather. The collection belonged to Mel. "Take your pick, Eddie," I said as I thrust the case in his direction. A look of bewilderment played across his face. He seemed unable to comprehend the situation, So he merely stared dumbly, first at the tomahawks, then at me, then at the onlookers, then back at the war hatchets again. "You took something from me," I said. "I'm here to take it back." "But the rules have changed. We fought on your terms before. Now we fight on mine." "Well," Eddie stepped in with every intention of busting me a good one in the mug, but thought better of it and took two steps back when I deftly armed myself with one of the weapons. Suddenly, the odds had evened out. Eddie was twice my size, but a blow from a keenly honed iron blade with some heft behind it, even delivered by a small man, could do some mighty mean damage. Simple Simon was enraged as I taunted him to take the remaining hatchet, and he nearly did half a dozen times, but always pulled back at the last moment. He knew that I was more nimble, quicker, and his size no longer was an advantage, it was actually a disadvantage. As we circled, my eyes took in the small gathering, and right in the middle was Paul in full corporeal form, it appeared, dressed as casually as the locals in faded blue jeans and a rustic plaid shirt. He wore a look of detachment, but I wasn't fooled. He was with me. "Come on, Eddie, let's get to it," I taunted as I tracked him while he circled slowly, trying to keep his distance from me and the tomahawk clutched in my right hand. The case with the remaining blade lay on the ground, an open invitation to him. "You are crazy," Eddie growled. "Fight like a man." He wanted to smash me, a puny little squirt who was ridiculing him. But I could tell that he was thinking, probably about the pain of one blow from that blade digging into his ribcage, slicing through his neck, or splitting open his skull. Of course, he could do the same damage to me, if he was lucky. But he didn't like the odds. "Do you know what we do in California?" I asked. "We jog. We run. We exercise. We stay fit. At least a lot of us do. California people practically live outdoors." He was a lumbering clown, rolls of fat ringing his midsection, thick jowls fit for a prize porker, waddles that would make any turkey proud. He was an out-of-shape old man now. It must have been quite a come-down. He was puffing as we circled each other, with him looking for one opening, just one good opening to club me with one of his massive fists. If he had found it, it would have been curtains for me. But he just wasn't fast enough. 4 times I quickly shifted the weapon to my right hand and caught him flat-footed. I was in a good position to take a poke at him if I had wanted to. Instead, on one of those 4 occasions I merely gave him my specialty a fillip, a flick of the finger on the tip of his nose. I was not losing this battle. But there is a certain dubious honor even for the loser in a fistfight: the bloody and or broken nose, the puffed lip, the cut on the cheek, the puffy eye. All marks of manliness in fighting circles. And there is nothing macho about being disdainfully flicked on the nose as though you were as insignificant as a minat. I was now taking that away from Eddie, also the machismo. I was emasculating a once proud, physically powerful human being, psychologically castrating him. This was unfinished business that finally was being dealt with. But he refused to pick up the hatchet that reposed in the case on the ground. He knew that if he did, the confrontation could take on a most deadly turn, especially if I were as crazy as he suspected. If I was capable of moving in, flicking his nose with the snap of a finger and then moving out of range before he could react, then I would be able to chop him to pieces if we got into a serious battle with the weapons. Without a gun, he was defenseless. I fervently hoped that he wouldn't go for the weapon in one insane moment. You see, I was bluffing. There was no way that I could have brought myself to hit him with the deadly blade. I would have had to concede by turning tail and getting my carcass out of there. More than once I caught sight of Paul leaning against a tree just beyond the small group of onlookers. He didn't look pleased, but then he didn't control my life either. Ultimately, at the moment, I was the master of my own destiny. Finally, after about 10 minutes, confused, angry, and dispirited, Simple Simon turned his back on me, pushed his way through the small crowd, and walked away, leaving behind not only his windbreaker but part of himself, which lay broken on the ground. I packed up the case, along with what I considered my reclaimed dignity and self-respect, put on my jacket and strode out of the clearing in the woods with Mel practically slobbering all over me. I handed him the case with the tomahawks. "Thanks for the loan," I said. "They came in real handy." "Oh, man, you really destroyed him," Mel chimed gleefully.